Welcome to the Content That Grows podcast, where we chat with folks from all kinds of companies to better understand the content they've invested in, how they did it, and how it impacted the growth of their company. I'm Nate Turner, co-founder and CEO of 10speed.io. Today, I'm chatting with Sangram Vajray. Sangram is a three-time best-selling author that co-founded Terminus in 2014 and has been teaching the business of marketing with his signature frameworks ever since. He's an international keynote speaker, was named one of the top 21 B2B marketing influencers in the world, and is the host of a top 50 business podcast called Flip My Funnel. I'm super excited for this. Let's get started. Hey, Sangram, thanks so much for joining us today.
Nate, I'm glad we actually are able to do this now that we went through a bunch of snafus here and there, so I'm excited.
Yes. Besides all the technology issues, we are here, we're chatting, and glad to be doing it. So let's jump right in. You just launched a book. Congrats. It's called Move. It's a framework for go-to-market. So I'd love to just start there. Tell us a little bit about the new book and what was behind your motives for writing it.
Thanks, Nate. This is my third book, so haven't gone through the ringer a couple of times. And this was, I feel, I used COVID to my full advantage of research because... Nice. During the COVID time, I think the one thing that was good was you could pick up the phone and call anybody. And most people were open to have conversations around it. So ended up interviewing like Jeffrey Moore, who wrote Crossing the Chasm, to Brian Halligan, who's the CEO of HubSpot, to Nick, CEO of Gainsight, like just across the board, VC, CEOs. And the genesis really was the fact that why do companies, especially great companies, fail? And there's a study. People are welcome to go and do a research on this. You can search for SaaS Valley of Death. And when you type that out and research, you will see a bunch of articles talking about that when companies hit about $10 million in revenue, when most of us might think, oh, it's great. Mm-hmm. Just in our own terminus, I feel like we've gone from 0 to 10 to now about 50. We have gone through this Valley of Death where companies after $10 million go there to die. Which is ridiculous. It's like 0.04% of the companies even make it between 10 and 50. So the numbers are really, really bad. And it all comes down to the fact that it's not because they don't die because the vision all of a sudden becomes obsolete. It's not because they can no longer hire great people that they used to do or their product sucks and nobody wants to buy it. It's none of that. It's actually the fact that their go-to-market actually never evolved, never matured, and they were not able to transform that. And that's really what the book is about, is to help you figure out your next move.
Awesome. Love that. Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I remember at Sprout hitting that 10 million point, and then, you know, and then years later kind of looking back on that and realizing like that was such, like, you didn't realize at the time, but it was such an inflection point of like marketing, but also, yes, broader market or go to market, sales and a lot of the other stuff around that really had to change a lot to go to 50 and then, you know, 100 and beyond. So, I love that. So you said you used COVID, used like the time. So there's a lot of interviews, inputs from people. I would just love to kind of understand, like, with building that, like, what are some of the conversations that have sort of opened up around you, like opportunities for you or for Terminus or anything like that? Like, sort of what's come out of that was maybe unexpected for you in all those conversations and writing the book and everything?
Yeah, there are three big aha moments for me in this. One was around who owns go-to-market. Yeah. I think I was shocked, and I think most people who are listening to it will be shocked around it as to when they, because we started with 50 broad questions, and then this was one of the most common questions we asked, and I was shocked by that. So I'll share that. Yeah. The second thing was who is on your go-to-market team? I think that was very important to understand and talk through, because a lot of times it's misunderstood. To one or the other team. And the third one really was around this notion of how do you know your go-to-market is broken? And I think anybody listening right now who may think that, well, I think we got pretty good here. It might be an humbling experience for you if I share some of the reasons why, how do you know your go-to-market is broken? Those will be the conversations happening right now today in your office as you're listening to it, and you will hear it. So I'll go through the first one. So if I forget my lost my chain of thought, you know, bring me back on those three questions.
For sure. Yeah.
So the first one was, who owns go-to-market? And as a marketer by trade, I thought, well, you know, marketing CMOs, I initially thought, well, you know, they're the execution arm that they probably do, or CRO maybe. Mm-hmm. Across the board, every single CEO said they own it. And I'll just bring Brian's example again. When I said, Brian, come on now, you are a CEO of a publicly traded company. You got 100,000 plus customers. And if you're saying that you own it just as a, because the buck stops at CEO, then sure. I get it. No, he's like, no, you don't understand. I have only three jobs as a CEO. I own the vision. I have to iterate on it. I need to make sure that everybody in the understanding, new people, like everybody just knows, the investors, the customers, we know where we're going.
Yep.
To the culture, if we can't hire great people, we won't be able to build a great company. So I own that, no matter who it is in the company responsible for it. And number three, which is the unsexy part of it, the part that is least talked about and probably had the most impact on anything that you're doing, is go to market. Yep. And that was echoed by every single CEO interview I ever did after that. Mm-hmm. And it was very eye-opening to me, is that, oh my God, the CEO truly owns it. So Nate, I'll ask for your input there. Is like, what do you think about that?
I would say from my experience, I would definitely agree. I think for sure day-to-day and even a lot of strategy, I do think is... living with those, you know, head of marketing, CRO, any of those types. But you're working with Justin as well as in consulting, work with a number of other CEOs. I feel like they just continue to have the bigger vision, like whether it's international expansion or product expansion, all these things that do ultimately influence go to market in some way. I think they're just, you know, especially once you get to that point of scale, they're 2 or 3 years ahead of where everyone else is thinking. And they don't stop thinking about it because it's the lifeblood of the business. So,
and you nailed it. Nailed it, Nate, because that's literally what Brian and others were talking about. Like, hey, look, who else is in this company right now, or any company at any given point, thinking about, should we acquire another company? Should we go and open an EMEA? Should we do a partnership? I mean, you may have inputs and you want those inputs, but you are the one who is actually seeing all these inputs connect, and you're connecting the dots. So go-to-market is much, much bigger. He even defined go-to-market as a product. He's like, go-to-market is not, and I put that as this quote on the back of the book because that was such a eye-opening quote. He's like, well, it's like a product. You don't go to an offsite for 2 days and come up with your go-to-market strategy. No. That's your vision casting. That is team building. That go-to-market is a product. You're constantly iterating on it and figuring out what works, what doesn't. So that was one big aha moment.
Cool.
The second one was like, well, how do you know it's broken? Well, the way you know it's broken is because of some of these conversations that are happening in your organization right now. If you're talking about, and in your organization is like, hey, you know, we are able to bring new customers fast. That's working for us, but we can't retain them. Yep. The go-to-market is broken because it's the sales, marketing, CS is not connected. Yep. Maybe you have your it's end of the month, and you know, you have your couple of salespeople who heroically saves the day and gets you over the number or something like that. And you celebrate that. That's actually bad. Very bad, because it means that you don't have it's like it's not a scalable, repeatable. You can't forecast, you know, the next quarter and the following quarter like that. And gold market is broken. You may have this challenge where you have a demand problem as well as acceleration problem, because your deals are not moving fast enough. In your you got to go to market. There's a messaging issue there. There's like somehow stuff is broken in it. And a lot of times I also see where the executive team is at a different level and different place than the team that are working in the trenches. And you're like, I don't even know what you're talking about here. I understand you're, you know, thinking ahead, but I don't understand, how does it help me close my deals better? And you have this constant pull of not connecting the dots. You got a go-to-market problem. So a lot of it is very humbling in many ways. And I'm sure, Nate, in your work with CEOs and others, you've heard some of them.
I think that all makes a lot of sense. The other thing sort of came to mind as you were kind of working through that list was just, I think there's a lot of marketers that get that feeling, get that pressure perhaps. And that's when you start to see folks that are, you know, slipping outside of ideal targeting just to get the numbers up or whatever, to kind of like hit their lead number or traffic or whatever it is they're tasked with. And then again, just sort of all trickles down. Like, we kind of slip there, but then you have like lower close rates, or you do close them and they don't stay, like you said. So totally agree.
Yeah. So that was it. So one was who owns go to market. It's the CEO. Big revelation. Number two, like, how do you know it's broken? These are things and conversations. And one of the challenge and encouragement I'll give everybody is to step up. And when you hear stuff like that, like, step into it, because these are the things what kills companies. This is what value of death is all about. Yeah. And the third area was around who is on your go-to-market team. So in the book, Nate, we talk about these three P's framework of the stages of business: problem market fit, product market fit, and platform market fit. The three P's: problem, product, platform. Yep. And in the early days, when you're in the problem market fit, you probably have a founder-led, sales-led go-to-market. That's really your go-to-market team.
Yep.
And then as you become a product market fit in the most proverbial sense, you probably see sales and marketing working very closely together as one team, and target accounts and ABM and all these things become very important.
Yep.
But as you go to platform market fit, this is where Jeffrey Moore really helped us think bigger. He's like, I just came from a conversation with Mark Benioff. He's still advising them as Salesforce, and it's like a 5-day workshop or whatever he did. And he's like, I tell you, if you don't put your customer success ahead of sales and marketing, you will never be a platform market fit company. And the reason is, at that time, when you become a platform market fit, which means you have more than one product and you have a customer base, now you're thinking about customer cohorts. Which customers are the best customers? You're not thinking about new customers only. You're thinking about which customers are the best customers we want. High retention rate, your net retention rate becomes, the NRR becomes a really, really important metric for your business. And if your customer success team is not part of your go-to-market team on identifying which net new customers come from and what they look like and what your ICP is, then you have missed the boat. You actually will never be a successful platform market fit company. And so I think recognizing and bringing CS early as part of your go-to-market team is going to help companies navigate this valley of death better.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. And also just the progression makes sense, because the further you are into the age of the company and the more customers you have, obviously the more you have to have data around customer success on whatever it's churn, or, you know, how long until people expand, how much, you know, what's the, you know, the net revenue retention, kind of all that stuff. So that's awesome. Cool. So I love that. Can't wait to grab my copy and check it out. Definitely recommend everyone checks out Move, the latest book from Sangram. With that, I would love to kind of jump back a little bit into your career before you were writing books. Moving back to, you know, you were head of marketing at Pardot. So, you know, early teens, 2013, 14, 15, something like that. I'd love just kind of high level, like, how much was content, in when I say content, you know, blog, webinars, ebooks, anything sort of in that realm, content marketing, like, how much was that part of your go-to-market? How much were you really thinking about, that as an effective channel to grow the brand, grow pipeline or revenue, any of that stuff?
So Pardot at that time was one of the best, I think, we went in terms of the team of creating content. I still remember we used to generate like 3,000 plus leads every single month because of the amount of content and all the things that just came in. It was fantastic. One thing we did, Nate, that might be interesting to you and your audience, is we actually created life-size persona posters in the office. And we called them like it was Maggie the marketer and Sam the sales guy. So they had names. They were actual life-size like posters in the office in many different corners. And they had a whiteboard with them holding, kind of thing.
Okay.
And what we did was we made sure that everybody in the organization recognizes that every time we create content, we need to have this mental picture of who we are creating. Are we creating for Maggie or Sam? And Maggie, the marketer, Sam, the sales guy, really help people think about what would Maggie want to see? What would Maggie care about? Well, Maggie cares about different things than Sam. So it helped people to think about, okay, I'm creating this content for Sam. I'm creating this content for Maggie. I'm creating this to help Maggie and Sam understand each other better. So it helped our content strategy a lot more by having those physical personas in literally every con. You go to get a coffee, you will see Maggie, right? You'll go to get a printer, you will see Sam. So it constantly enforces the fact that who we create content for. And I feel right now, we sometimes, I see content from a lot of companies. I think I seem like, wait a minute, who is this for? Like it burns my calories sometimes. Is it for me or not? And I would say every content marketer out there, it will serve you better if you're not burning calories of your buyers and customers, and they just know exactly who this is for.
Yeah, totally agree. Yeah, that's really cool. And it sounds like, so you mentioned it drove a lot of leads. So that was a pretty metric driven thing. You were tracking quite a bit. Were you also, at that time, tracking all the way through kind of into the CRM and pipeline and everything, or was it just kind of the top of funnel leads, MQLs kind of stuff?
So part of after the acquisition was a completely different marketing sales process, right? Because at that time, we are not part of the mothership, the sales force. So we didn't really even need to go and get new customers. We were literally selling in the base, in the Salesforce ecosystem. So a lot of our marketing shifted to be more like, all right, how does Pardot work with Salesforce? And really engaging a lot of the thousands and thousands of customers of Salesforce, because we were like 0.1% of their customer base that use Pardot. So marketing changed quite a bit after that. But I will say that the inbound was so great that it actually was a bad thing at one point, because what do you do with that many leads, right? Would you keep nurturing them? Would you do pass it all to the sales team and all that stuff? So we did something called, which led me to start Terminus after those couple of years, is we would walk in every month into a sales meeting. I'll attend. I never missed a sales meeting. Ever as a marketer, never ever missed a sales meeting. So we would walk in once a month though with my team in there, and we would walk through the journey of a customer. So we'll find a closed one customer and we'll say, hey, this, Chris on the sales team, congratulations, you closed this big deal that we have for, customer X. But let's look at what happened with customer X. And we'll walk through that and say, well, customer X actually came 2 years ago through this event. And then that customer X downloaded these 5 different pieces of content. So kudos to the content team, because they now know that their content matters. Yep. Then there are 5 more people from that team came about and they actually attended webinars. And in that month, when you actually turned that into an opportunity, they were like hot and heavy on this. So we had like 2 interns doing this digging. At that time, there wasn't really end-to-end connection at that point. So events team, webinar team, kudos to you and the sales team. If you invite people to a webinar that we are doing, it increases the chance of you closing the deal by 33%. So we kind of changed the way we talk to the sales team. We didn't say, hey, look at all the new content we are creating. Look at all the great stuff we're doing. It didn't matter. We actually took them to a customer that had revenue from start to finish, made sure that they recognized the content that we're creating on the blog, on the webinar and stuff actually drove business for them. Guess what? Next time we have a webinar, we literally have to say 33%. Remember, that helps you drive business. And people, the sales team will like invite all of their future customers into that. So I think that was one of the best things that we ended up doing, and the team loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. That's very cool. And how big, kind of prior to acquisition then, was the content team in terms of like in-house contractors, anything like that? Like,
yeah, we had like 3 of them. I was counting, like, I think Molly, Jenna, like we had like 3 people fully focused on content. Then we had an interactive, Matt used to do interactive design. So he created a lot of the early, this is 2014. So I didn't think there was that. At that time, there was infographic was all the rage.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So he created a lot of not just infographic things, but interactive infographics. So you can click and move to the next level and that kind of stuff.
Yep.
That was pretty cool at that time. We saw like tremendous amount of people just spending time on the site, like 5 minutes, 7 minutes engaging with that pieces of content. So it was three people doing content and then one interactive developer that we call them as part of the content team.
Yeah. Very cool. Awesome. And you alluded to, you know, some of that experience and having too many leads that sometimes being a challenge. You know, what do you do with them? Do you nurture them forever? That was got your brain thinking a little bit differently. Sounds like it led to the concept of flipping the funnel.
So we'd
love to just kind of understand. You know, I remember talking to you a long time ago, like as you were starting Terminus and just like learning about it and doing all that. I would love to just kind of understand in that process, how did your perspective on content change specifically? So obviously there's like a lot that goes into shifting into ABM and flipping the funnel. But I don't know if we'll be able to get into all of that today, but you know, how did your perspective on content change as you kind of took on a new perspective of marketing?
Nate, I think the biggest move that happened for me was when we had 3,000 plus leads every month and just doing great work. I remember having a conversation with one of the sales leaders who said, Sangram, you and your team doing phenomenal job of leads. Can you generate 1,000 more leads every month? And I'm like, wait a minute. We're not even converting like any like very small percent of this. Why are we not talking about pipeline velocity? Why are we not talking about like expand? Like, you know, why do we need 1,000 more leads? And they were just hiring more and more sales reps and the BDRs and SDRs to do that. And it literally, I sunk in my seat that day. And I felt like I'm no better than a coin-operated lead machine at this very moment. And that really was, to your point, the genesis of like, all right, there got to be a better way to talk about this. I need to elevate what marketing is and what it does. And there wasn't really anything on the market at that time that I could find that will help me do that better. So that led to starting Terminus and said, we need to go and do this because there's nobody else doing it. So it was my pain point, honestly, personal pride around the fact that marketers are better than coin operated lead machine. And I didn't want any other CMO and marketer to ever feel that again. So ABM, when I think about content, it is about one-to-one content. Like I see a day where companies don't even need marketing automation for that matter. And I'm seeing that already happening where you if you're really doing one-to-one, you don't need automation to send. You can use MailChimp or something else to send emails about newsletters and webinars that are generic. Sure. But your one-to-one, majority of your conversation needs to be one-to-one. So you could use SalesLoft or Outreach for that today or something else tomorrow, like whatever comes out. But the one-to-one conversation matters. And I'll give you an example of how Snowflake, our early customer, did that. At that time, they were very small when they started with us and very early days. I wish I would have bought more stock into Salesforce and into Snowflake at that time. But they literally started with this idea of like, hey, look, you know what? We are closing 100,000 plus deals. And the way their software worked was any customer comes in, they immediately over the next 6 months almost start spending $1 million. It's like an AP, you know, the way the pricing works and the infrastructure cost expands and stuff. So it was like incredible. And the retention was 100%. Like people, it's sticky software. Awesome. So the way they said was we need to do more one-on-ones. So Daniel, who ran ABM over there at that time, literally hired interns to run one-to-one campaigns. And he would create one-to-one websites like microsites from them to have by the interns saying, all right, create snowflake.com/Levi's, snowflake.com/Sony, whatever the name of those companies are that you're going. 80% of the content would be the same about how Snowflake really helps, you know, your company to do, you know, all the stuff they do. But the top 20% of the content was very specific to that company with their colors, with their logo, with their value prop, and a video of their customer success person or salesperson saying how we want to, hey, we feel that you're one of our best fit account. We feel that we can serve you, and here's how we think we can. Gosh, I mean, think about the conversion on that page that they got. Like, nobody's finding that page unless somebody sends you an ad or an email on that. It was ridiculously high. So I feel the content needs to mature to really do the heavy work in the beginning. And the more heavy work you do, the better conversions you're going to get. And in their case, like, out of 100 accounts that they created, 80, 90% of them responded. Either they saying, oh, I love this, but I'm not a good time, or like, I love this, and you know what, let's engage. So one of it, you did get a response. And I think that's part of what content marketing needs to be about.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So I would love for you to speak to this, because I feel like I've seen a lot of, and just talking with folks, a lot of different perspectives, and some people can get pretty fired up about this. So obviously with Terminus, you still have a blog, and you still do, you know, webinars or some different content marketing aspects to it. There's certainly the one-to-one, but there's still some one-to-many. And I have just heard so much from marketers that like ABM is anti-content almost. And so I just would love for it, like, your perspective on how you see those working together, and sort of the role that it's not, you know, let's gate everything and bring in, you know, thousands of leads to nurture them. But what is the role of that content marketing in that context?
One, there was a conversation that I had with Joe Paluzzi, who runs Content Marketing Institute. So pretty much in the realm of like what you and your audience probably, about and talk about and subscribe to. And I remember his conversation around this, where he said something that stuck in my brain. And I think we have done a lot of those things at Terminus now. He said, really, what you really need is one piece of content that is gated. But that piece of content should be the best piece of content and something that everybody would want. So whoever is listening right now, think about it in your industry. Maybe it is the state of your industry, not your company, but state of your industry. Maybe it is the research report that is all about that. Maybe it is a way to collect interviews of a lot of people in your industry that comes out as a real thought leadership piece that is so unique, so personalized, so valuable that people would sign up. So you create that one piece of content, and that's all you really need to capture information. You don't need to capture it for every single thing. Right. And 99% of the content that you should be creating should be educational. That drives, again, people to that big piece of content and support it. So I think there is this, instead of gating every single thing under the sun, like, we should stop doing that. And I think if you look at Terminus today, we really have nothing gated outside of like that one thing that we do, state of ABM report. We've been doing that for 5 years now. Yep. And everything else is literally available for anybody to download and look at. We have seen where we used to gate, and like, nobody's reading this amazing piece of content. Like, what's wrong?
Exactly.
Yep. So not even the people in your own company are reading it. Like, what's the point? So ungating will actually help more consumption, but it needs to be in the service of that one thing that drives business.
Yep. Cool. Awesome. That's helpful. So real quick, I also would love to just kind of hear, you also started and run the Peak community. So maybe just talk a little bit about what that is, and just sort of how that's also, again, sort of like kind of building your audience and your reach and influence and stuff, like, you know, a little bit about what it is, why you wanted to do it, and what's doing for you.
Oh, yeah. I appreciate you sharing that. Like, so Peak also started in the COVID time. Because, like, I'm a community geek. Like, I love hanging out with peers, but every community I saw, it was either sponsored by vendors or run by people who are, you know, like, there's literally no community out there that wasn't just a community, right? Like, it's always sponsored. And I understand you need to pay the bills. So we said, well, what about, you know, me and Judd, who started this a year ago, we were like, what if we started this? And big reason for that Osborne was both of us were getting reached out to for people. He's an amazing recruiter. So he's always hiring leaders in CMO positions and leading positions in marketing and sales. Yeah. And obviously being a CMO a few times, I get reached out by a lot of people saying, well, how do you become a CMO? Like, what does it take to become a CMO? So he said, okay, so let's start a community with a clear goal. Our goal is to help 100 CMOs, like 100 marketers become CMOs in the next few years. Like that's our goal. So it is for emerging CMOs and CMOs who want to be better at CMO. So all of a sudden, a lot of people who joined were also CMOs. So we had to create a CMO group because they wanted to talk about all the challenges that they have within their CMO world and to be better CMOs. So ended up having all of it. So they're now about 500 or so paid. So everybody's paid. So they pay for being part of the community. That's how we pay for Zoom and all the events and activities that happen in it. But we haven't tried to get a single sponsor around it because we want it to be run by the community, for marketers to talk about marketing stuff. And we talk about like the business of marketing, like how do you become a CMO? What does the compensation look like for it? How do you talk about equity? How do you actually go in a boardroom and have that conversation? So we're not talking about hacks and tricks or any of it. We were talking about like actual issues that will help you become a CMO one day or stay as a CMO. Like how do you hire for diversity when you're saying that somebody's saying, hey, we need to hire in the next 30 days. You don't have diversity candidates right now, but the board is saying that you better have diversity. Like it's crazy. It's hard sometimes to do those things. And, and there is no safe place for you to talk about it. So that's what Peak Community is all about.
Very cool. And how, I mean, has that benefited you personally too? I mean, I assume just like
pulling
together so many people, like personal growth for you too.
Yeah, absolutely. Like network wise, like these are people who are paying and want to be. So these are, there's no sellers here. There's nothing. There's all marketing. So it's really like people are very safe and like, it's really awesome. I feel like I'm hanging out, you know, in my own little pod a little bit. Even with the book, I'll tell you, man, I was very clear about it. I released it in the community 6 months before the book launched.
Had
the community review it and had their feedback on it. I put all of their names who reviewed the book in the back of the book, making sure that I give shout out to them. When we launched the book, all of a sudden, like we have sold over 6,000 copies of the book in first week. And I would give a lot of that shout out to the community to helping get the word out because they were part of the process of building and writing this book. So for me, that wasn't the plan. I wasn't planning this and this to be together, but it all happened and I'm grateful for it. And that's how we're supporting each other. There are other people who are writing books. There are people who are like, hey, I got an interview and it's a role for a VP. Like, you know, what questions should I be asking? So it's literally a very supportive group or like, hey, you know, I'm looking for the next gig. We don't want any more marketers looking for a gig. Like it just, no, like that's the last time you should ask for a gig. You should already be connected with other marketers. So we see a lot of CMOs hiring emerging CMOs to be in their company. We saw recently a person become a CMO and moved into a CMO group. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. Really cool. So I guess real quick, you know, a couple other questions and we'll wrap up. You know, what advice, I guess, you know, because you've obviously had several years now, heavy, heavy lead gen focus in the context of ABM, community, writing books, like, you know, content has sort of spanned in one way or another a lot of your career. So with companies that are, folks that are at companies wanting to grow their company, grow the brand, grow the audience, through content, like what are some of the learnings or like advice you would give along those lines?
Well, so one is like, I'll share just my own personal story on this one. 3 years ago, I made a commitment that I'm just going to learn. I'm going to learn to put something out there. And this was a question, Nate, somebody asked me about 4 years ago saying that Sangram, are you growing at the rate your company is growing? And I was stumped. Because I wasn't, right? I mean, we were growing at over 100% year over. I'm like, I'm not growing over 100% as a person. Like, it's just not true, right?
Yeah.
And if most of us are truthful to yourself, I think we all could say that, you know, that's just a high order to say that, hey, I'm growing. You know, we are growing and we should always be growing. But like that, like I was stumped.
Yeah.
And I made a commitment to learn every day. And that's when I said, well, the only way to learn is to share what I'm learning every day and ask and engage and figure out a way to just make that part of my routine. So 3 years ago, I made a commitment saying, all right, I'm going to pick LinkedIn as a platform because I'm not on most of other, like I'm sporadic here and there, but every day I will post something and it didn't matter what engagement I get or not. I'll just share something I learned or learn something new or engage with somebody new. And I just made that part of my routine. It just haven't changed that. And what that did for me was that it just became a way of me to just get new thoughts into the system. It helped me test new messages that we said, oh, that poll just went bonkers. So that is really the pulse of the market. And then that we applied to the stuff that we're doing in the community or in the company. So it just helped me grow. So if somebody's new looking at it and saying, you don't need to compare yourself with anybody. I think that's like the hardest and the worst thing you could possibly do. The second worst thing you could do is look back and see what happened with your post. But trust me, nobody's looking at that. Like their post, even today, I would get like zero engagement, like not zero, but like less engagement than others. But that's not the point. You should always know. Sometimes my post is about promoting somebody and somebody's work. Like that's the ROI on it. Sometimes my post is to find something. So I'll do a poll or a question. So that's my ROI. It's hardly sometimes where like the book was one where I'm like, I need more people to engage with this because I put so much research into it and I want this to go forward. So that's a different thing where I'm actively promoting that. So if you have a learner's mindset, I think you would see people would be drawn to you. If you have a taker's mindset that all you're doing is taking, or looking for people to like constantly like tagging 1,000 people in your post, like you're doing all those kind of things, then you're going to be, it's going to be less heartfelt, less authentic, and it's not going to drive your personal brand or anything like that. So make a commitment of doing something consistently creates massive outcomes in my opinion. And then when you make a commitment, just do it and don't look back for a year. Just do it for a year. And then when you look back, I think you would find something amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. And it's cool to hear. Cause I remember seeing, just your LinkedIn Live stuff popping up a few years ago. So it's kind of cool to hear a little bit behind that it wasn't like, hey, Sangram's got this whole, you know, well-polished media plan that he's going to roll out. Like you were just forcing yourself to do it and learn and grow. So that's really cool.
And it is hard, mate. Like, I mean, it is hard with your day job. It is hard to go through it. And there's ebbs and valleys. Like as you said, I did lives for a few weeks and then I stopped doing it. So you would change, you would evolve, but I never changed the fact that I will do it every day for as long as I feel it's important for me to do this thing. And I did that for 3 months, then 6 months and a year. And now it's just part of my routine.
Yep. Yep. That's awesome. Cool. And you know, as you're kind of evolving, you're looking ahead, like what content channel, content format, things like that, what are you kind of bullish on right now or looking at that you think is going to be, you know, big in the next, 6, 12, 18 months, something like that?
I honestly don't feel like, you know, look, there was a lot of about Clubhouse and I'm like, I never into it. And, you know, we all know, I don't know who else is on Clubhouse anymore or whatever. Right. So I'm always thinking about the fact that it really doesn't matter. What matters, the channel is, I think thinking about a channel is important, but may not be the best thing. So for example, I picked LinkedIn purely because that's where I felt like the professionals are. That's the audience that I want to connect with. So I'm not on Facebook. I'm hardly on Twitter, unless there's an event or anything like that. Instagram, maybe here and there, but it really on LinkedIn. That is, so I picked one. So I would say pick one that makes your style of conversation and your audience exist on it. And whatever that is, then go full in on it. A lot of times people do 50 things everywhere, and then you just spread too thin. It's not possible for you to keep up with it unless you are Gary Vee and you have a team of 18 people doing it for you. It's different. If you're doing it by yourself, pick one, go bullish on it, and you will find great things come out of it. You learn so much. And even if that channel no longer exists, you have just picked up on some skills there that you can move on to other things.
Yep. Cool. Love it. So I got one more question for you before we wrap up. If you want, visit 10speed.io/podcast where you can check out the show notes. Be sure to subscribe, tell other marketers, content folks that you know about this podcast, and please check out Sangram's new book, Move. And so with that, Sangram, will wrap up with one last question, which is just anything else you'd like to, any, you know, parting advice or anything else you'd like to share with folks today?
Well, there's one thing that I say, and I've said to myself a lot, which is that being intentional is more important than being brilliant.
Cool. Yeah.
And I've learned that for myself a lot. Like, a lot of times we all think we have brilliant things, ideas and stuff. I'll tell you, people who are intentional about it and do something go further than the people who are brilliant sitting at a coffee table coming up with ideas. So yeah. Do something, be intentional, way, way better, more important than being brilliant.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. Love it. Cool. Well, Sangram, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Nate, for having me.